I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, we feature a unique discussion on the intersections of cinema, culture, and gastronomy. Our guests are Stuart Brioza and Nicole Krasinski, renowned chefs and owners of State Bird Provisions and The Progress, and San Francisco Film Society's Rachel Rosen. This conversation took place at the JCCSF prior to a film screening of Ang Lee's poignant family drama, Eat, Drink, Man, Woman. And now, join me on stage at the JCCSF as I introduce Stuart Brioza, Nicole Krasinski, and Rachel Rosen. We are so honored to host Stuart Brioza and Nicole Krasinski, chefs and owners of State Bird Provisions and The Progress, for a conversation on the artistic process, food, film, and everything in between. Here at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, we seek to help you thrive in body, mind, and spirit, and to think about things deeply and from many different perspectives. Stuart and Nicole's creative, inquiring voices and their work pushing boundaries in their field, bringing art and creativity to their food and the whole dining experience, help us do those things and also provide a lot of fun while doing it, too. So just some logistics before I pass this over to Rachel Rosen. Stuart, Nicole, and Rachel will sit down in conversation here first. Then we'll have time for your questions. After their onstage conversation, we'll take a little break in the atrium. We'll come back in here if you want to stay, and we'll screen Eat, Drink, Man, Woman starting at 8 o'clock. So without further ado, I'd like to turn this over to Rachel Rosen, Director of Programming for the San Francisco Film Society.
Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for coming. I just first want to start and echo Jordan's sentiments about how much fun it has been working on this Food on Film series with the Jewish Community Center. I want to thank the wonderful staff. We've really been enjoying putting these on, so thanks for having us be a part of them. So we're so excited to be embarking on tonight's program on food and film and food on film. We're going to talk about all sorts of things. Ang Lee's 1994 Eat, Drink, Man, Woman will be part of the conversation, but we're just going to go where the conversation takes us. There's no need to really explain why Stuart Brioza and Nicole Krasinski were an obvious choice for this program. Their renown as restaurateurs and chefs is pretty wide. They've won so many awards that it would probably take, you know, too much of our evening to list them all, but they include a 2015 James Beard Award, Best Chef West, State Bird 2013 James Beard Award for new Best New Restaurant, also Bon Appetit's Restaurant of the Year for their newer restaurant, The Progress, that opened towards the end of 2014. They made Food & Wine's inaugural list of Best New Restaurants, Esquire's Best New Restaurant in America. Could go on. There are other sort of wonderful serendipitous reasons why it's a pleasure to do this program tonight. The Progress, as you may know, was originally, or since 1911, a movie palace called The Progress. It opened in 1911. It was actually run by Kalin and Greenfield, who were circuit programmers who also ran a theater called the New Fillmore, which doesn't exist anymore. But they also ran the New Mission, which is now the Alamo Drafthouse New Mission, where we had our first food on film program. And The Progress was also twice the hospitality suite at the San Francisco International Film Festival. So we feel an aesthetic and a geographic connection to the program tonight. So without further ado, please welcome Stuart Brioza and Nicole Krasinski.
Hi there.
Hey. Hi.
Hi, everyone.
Hello.
Hi.
So, food on film, we're going to get to a little later. We're going to start with film and food separately and go back sort of early on. And I know, or I think I know, that you met in college.
You did. Actually
De Anza.
In 1995. So.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Very, very temporally appropriate, too.
Yes.
And you were in an art class. Is that correct?
We were photography students.
Okay.
Yes.
So that also has a film connection. So
absolutely.
I want to ask you a little bit about that. But I also just wanted to start by saying, like, you know, what were you early movie enthusiasts? Are you casual moviegoers?
Well, yeah, no, I think definitely early movie enthusiasts, especially in the kind of the visual arts that we were studying when we were photography students. And when I think back, you know, people would ask, you know, like, oh, what's your favorite movie? Or when posed with this challenge, you know, what were your favorite movies? And I always tend to go back to the movies that Nicole and I started watching together, things like tonight's movie, Eat, Drink, Man, Woman, you know, The Cook, the Thief, His Wife and Her Lover,
Delicatessen. Many Roman Polanski movies.
Yeah, Roman Polanski. You know, we like really that it were like visually and creatively, like, you know, with you know, movies that also had an international flair and kind of a rough edge to them. In many cases, those seem to be the ones that were really, you know, the sort of drove the independent aspect of what we were after.
And can you talk a little bit about your interest in photography? Because, I mean, I know often interest in films and photography can collide, and whether one led to another in any way.
Personally, the work that I was doing a lot in college was with food and photography. So I was baking bread and doing still lifes that incorporated food, and the one and only art show I ever had, I baked a lot of things for it and had images of that same food displayed in different ways. So there was, even before I knew sort of that I could have a career as a pastry chef, I was baking constantly and then taking pictures of it.
Interesting. That's really interesting.
Yeah. And for me, I just, you know, I like to take pictures of skateboarding and snowboarding, and was challenged by a roommate of mine when I, just after I finished high school, I lived in Utah, and I spent a year at Snowbird, and he's like, all right, so when I get that that jump, you know, I want you to click this camera. And it was a manual camera, and I grew up with, you know, those little 110 films that, you know, my mom would have that you sort of click and zip, 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 click. And this was a Nikon, I want to say like a 2020 or something, and it was all automatic. And he'd set the f-stop, and he'd set the shutter speed, and, you know, all right, focus on this. And then he would climb up, and I'd snap a photo of him. And I remember, you know, I was like, all right, I think I want to learn more about this. So,
now, when you was making movies part of the, you know, world around school, like, were there people in your photography class who were movie makers?
Yeah, I definitely took quite a few film classes along with the photography, but sort of maintained focus in the dark room throughout. But I think we were both watching a lot of movies and sort of going deeper into film because of the photography at that point, and eating a lot of popcorn.
Excellent. That's important. So when you were watching films, were you just doing it mostly for enjoyment or socializing, or, you know, were you looking specifically at things in the films you were watching to inform the way you were taking pictures?
I think that probably unconsciously, absolutely, yeah.
It started informing it. I think photography started informing the films that we were interested in, right?
Uh-huh.
And as you you know, like anything, the more you get involved and the more you practice and the kind of deeper you go, you know, you start off with one, I don't know, one film. I think, like, really Delicatessen, I remember, as being that film that just, like, blew my mind from a cinematography standpoint and storyline and just all the detail that went into it and kind of the going down that rabbit hole and really started to drive the films that we're looking
for. I do remember, though, there was one project that you worked on where you took pictures of Taxi Driver, like you would capture stills of that movie.
Oh, yeah.
And that was part of...
Yeah. Oh, that was... Wow. I had a very special high school I went to that we had a film instructor, and David Caruso was his name, and he the first movie that we watched was Taxi Driver by... Martin Scorsese. Like it was a very special high school.
High
school. Yes. And, that was really pretty, like, you know, it was, I remember finishing that movie thinking, I'm so lucky to be at this school. And, I remember our first trip to New York. I got into every taxi I got into, I would snap a photograph in this kind of raw black and white high contrast film and then ask, you know, have you seen that movie, Taxi Driver? You know, are you waiting for a hard rain to come down and wash the streets and, you know, clean up this city?
I don't think one ever had heard of the movie.
Oh, really?
There was that. Like, they'd look at me like, why are you talking to me?
And, don't ask me about that movie again.
Yeah. It's not like that they could talk on their cell phone because it didn't exist at that time, but it was, you know, they just sort of like look and just shake their head. And, you know, you're stop. Get out.
One of the themes of Eat, Drink, Man, Woman that I was going to talk about later is that, you know, the way food is used both as a way of communicating, but, you know, also as a substitute for communicating. But so then it kind of strikes me that, like, you guys watched a lot of movies together when you first started to know each other. Was that a way for you to get to know each other in terms of how you reacted to the movies or what you wanted to share with each other?
Sort of like on that first date, and she orders the chicken liver mousse, and you know that you've scored a good one. movies are sort of push boundaries in relationships, right? And I think, again, like going deeper and finding this interest and finding a conversation, like something to kind of grab onto that continues and evolves the relationship and the conversation. And I think food definitely does that.
And were you both already into food beyond as a photographic subject
I
at the time?
No. Yeah. No, I mean, I grew up in California in Los Gatos, so food was sort of in like the apricot tree in the backyard. That was kind of the way I was into food, was definitely like eating delicious fresh fruit at the peak of its ripeness, but not in a sense of like a restaurant or cooking kind of deeply.
So movies were more of a common language.
Yeah, and we at the time were exploring a lot of the same photographic processes in the darkroom, and so our aesthetics, we were looking at a lot of the same photographers and thinking like, how did they make that? How can we now reproduce that? And then as it evolved into food, our food sort of aesthetically went down the same road just as our photography exploration had.
I mean, it also strikes me like film, photography, food have in common that they're both very artistic and both very technical, meaning you have to, I mean, I guess most arts are when you stop to think about it, but you know, they both actually involve a chemical process
and time and temperature
that you have to get to understand.
Well, I think that's where like photography came in specifically, you know, with food is that, you know, you study a variety of different types of photography from, you know, various black and white and formats of cameras and developmental processes, but one of the most important skills that we had learned, both of us, and probably didn't realize until later many years later. Mm-hmm. And of course, it's applicable to, you know, anything that you're watching visually, but is the sort of Ansel Adams approach to photography, which is the zone system, pre-visualization of the image and kind of setting, looking at an image and really kind of questioning what you want as your contrast. And you're pre-visualizing the photograph, and then you snap it, take it to the dark room, go through the processes and push and pull and, you know, and overdevelop, underdevelop, underexpose, overexpose, and you're practicing all of these ideas that you've kind of thought about in the field. And it hit me about 10 years into my career as a chef that all that pre-visualization really enabled kind of a style of cooking. You think about food and you pre-visualize a dish, or especially in the early years, becoming a chef, when you're trying to develop your own sense of style, and your style is influenced by so many things, visual aspects, you know, travel, taste for sure, experience, and you wrap that into this idea of what your cuisine is going to be. And as a young chef, it's incredibly important. And as a more experienced chef now, you know, becomes less, it's a little less important, which is interesting, because you have that built into your cooking style. And it is defined.
And internalized.
And mm-hmm. internalized.
Somewhat too.
Yeah.
I mean, it's also interesting the way you describe Ansel Adams, because it, to me, it feels like there's an element of patience that you have to learn. And I think, you know, when people think about artists, especially in film, like films about artists, a whole other series that, you know, someday we'll have, you know, it's more like Jackson Pollock, right? Like throwing some stuff around and seeing if the magic happens. Whereas it seems like the reality is much more...
Well, there's
not
definitely
exactly,
a little bit of that.
You know, there's improvisation, but the methodical part mm-hmm. has to play into it also.
Yeah.
Okay, so I want to talk, like, segue into Eat, Drink, Man, Woman, just because I, you know, watching it again for this, it's such a great way of talking about so many things having to do with food and creativity and communication. But why don't you just start by talking about, you know, what your impressions were when you saw it back when you watched it in the 90s and, you know, when you were thinking about this, sometimes you have a vague memory of something you saw a long time ago, and that's what the really strong part is if it's not fresh in your mind.
I think the first 8 or so minutes of the movie are just this epic journey of a lifetime's worth of work from this, you know, master chef, where he's cooking as kind of a retired chef, but you don't know that in the beginning, right? You see this just mastery in his home kitchen, and it is just filled with sights and sounds, and you know, you start picking things out as he walks through. And maybe I don't think I picked up on it 20 years ago when I watched the movie, but you know, just rewatching it and seeing the pickle pots that he's pulling from, and you know, pickling, of course, is in such a part of what we do in our kitchens, and you know, and you know, grabbing the live chicken and then, you know, kind of, you know, slaughtering it and bringing it back into the kitchen. And, you know, there's just this, like, rawness to it. And it's completely, it's moving, right? Everything about it is moving. And you really feel like you're just transported into this lifetime's worth of work, which is pretty cool. And you really see that as a chef, perhaps as a diner as well. But, you know, I can relate to everything, like the way he's cutting vegetables and picking up on, like, wow, the Chinese technique of, you know, julienne vegetables with a cleaver, you know, that, and then kind of fanning it out, and then again, that, you know, and you just look at that going, ah, I got to try that, you know. You know, it's just so mesmerizing and just so, it's amazing, like, that kind of skill level.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There was a small scene that I remember. It's like very seared into my memory for some reason, where he made the little bento box for, I don't know if it's his niece or the little girl.
It's the child, neighbor girl.
Yeah, the neighbor girl. And I remember the scene so clearly. It was exactly as I had remembered it. This kind of like, wow, you've got this master chef who is taking so much pride in this little bento box and was so happy to like walk her to school and share this food with her.
You're listening to a discussion on the intersections of cinema, culture, and gastronomy with our guests Stuart Brioza and Nicole Krasinski, renowned chefs and owners of State Bird Provisions and The Progress, and San Francisco Film Society's Rachel Rosen on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
All right, so this brings up my first, like, how would a chef see it question? Because, of course, as I watched it again for this, and I was thinking, like, how would a chef look at this? And I was thinking, like, you know, for me, one of the things that always pulls me out of a movie is, like, when someone starts to play the piano. And then, because then I'm just thinking, well, can that actor really play the piano or not? Yeah. Because, you know, like, are they going to cut to that awkward thing where you just see, like, the piano bench and, like, the person looking over and then someone else's hands? So in this film, they actually had three chef advisors, one of whom was advising the actors on their body movements. And then they had, like, five chef hands. They needed like women's hands for when she makes the dumpling things. But I was just thinking, like, if you're a chef and you're watching that, do you just go like, "Ah, oh, it's not that guy"?
Yeah.
Like, can you like? Totally. Do you like?
Although he plays a pretty convincing role, right? But you're also like, no way, come on. You know, like that is like years worth of experience. You can't just pick up a cleaver and just you know, and you know, it just doesn't work that way.
I wrote down like knife work.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. But definitely. But I do think, and you can see it too in the filming, right? Where it's like really close ups to the hands and the, you know, and the ingredients and the mise en place that he's creating. And then of course it's a pull away phase where he's got the spoon and the tasting, you know, and it's like, oh yeah, of course that's him tasting, but you know, somebody else.
I mean,
getting it there.
Definitely not something I would ever even think about, like, unless I was doing this. But, I have a couple
Doesn't
more.
Everybody
of those,
have
so we'll
those mad skills.
Yeah, exactly. We'll see if they come up. Okay, so I also wrote down some quotes from the movie that I just thought would be good conversation starters. So the one is, you know, the first situation that you see is the meal that he's preparing is for to bring his three daughters over for Sunday dinner. Mm-hmm. And one of them just says, like, ugh, the Sunday dinner torture ritual. So, I mean, this just brought up so many questions about, like, cooking and family. So I wanted to ask you both, like, did what eating was like in your own families? Did you have like a Sunday dinner torture ritual, or were you like grab and go on the go families?
My mom cooked every breakfast, lunch, and dinner that we had. It was there were just four of us, and we ate every dinner together. It was, you know, pretty, wasn't anything fancy, but it was definitely important in our life. And I remember going to farmers markets at a young age and kind of knowing that fresh, delicious food was important, although she didn't use any salt, which I now question. But we, from the age of three, I was baking cookies and making bread and doing things homemade, so there was definitely, I think it was also something for me that I realized as someone who was pretty shy, that if I baked things for people, they would like want to be my friends. that happened through sort of just being in the kitchen with my mom.
So it seems like that was always a warm, like even totally. In the adolescence, there yeah. was no straining against no. the family meal.
No.
It's lovely. How about you?
Yes. You know, I grew up again in California as well in the South Bay. And you know, we were that family. We had artichoke on our table twice a week. I remember the four of us, my brother and I, mom and dad, and, you know, big blob of mayonnaise. And the artichoke was steamed, and we would all kind of eat and have a pile of leaves, and my father would pull the heart and carve it, and, you know, we'd all get a quarter of the heart. That was like a total ritual. I mean, I don't forget that at all.
What about artichokes? What did you do with the bad part? Was like...
Oh, yeah, that was part of the carving, yeah. You know, like, he took the choke out, and, you know, yeah, it was just this thing, and divvied it up, so everybody got an equal share, because we're all, like, the heart, right? And yeah, my mom did a lot of the cooking as well. She had her dishes, her fried chicken. We did fish on Fridays. We would go to Ray Street, which was a nice little fish market in the 70s and early 80s, not far from us, and I remember going in and seeing fish and Knob Hill Foods, where you know you'd see like you know lettuce on the ground. I always thought that like gauges the best markets is when you see like a lot of the produce, like the outer skins of things, like on the ground, you know. And I remember that pretty familiar and pretty well. And my father was like the king of the barbecue standard, you know, like dad barbecue, you know. You know, I mean, he could throw down a good, like, fried bologna sandwich at times. And, you know, and his kind of sauces of choice were his soignée sauce of, like, mayonnaise and ketchup. It was, you know, pretty typical, I think.
Excellent. I mean, there's a related issue to that, which is in the movie. I'm not going to give away too much, but I'm assuming many people will have seen the film. I won't do any major plot spoilers, but you know, one of the daughters learned to cook not from her father, but mm-hmm. from her father's friend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there's definitely, you know, a theme in the movie about mentoring. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to me because I feel like cooking is an art where mentoring is so important in a way that it isn't in other arts, right? Mm-hmm. Like you hear about young filmmakers and they just go, oh, they shoot their stuff in the backyard and then they go to film school. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it seems to be such a part of the cooking culture. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about mentorship in your mm-hmm. career and why you think that is. Like the people don't just go in the kitchen and... Mm. teach themselves.
Yeah.
You know, they teach by watching other people also.
I think cooking it's a craft and it's like cabinet making. You know, you don't just pick up a saw and just start making cabinets. You work for somebody, ideally who's got a sense of mastery and years of experience and, you know, it's a big, big part of it. I think, you know, being like a young chef that was gaining a lot of media attention was great. Now that I'm a little older, I'm thinking, God, but it's really like this food that I'm cooking right now that's real. And there's kind of a wisdom and a style and a comfortability with your own being in the kitchen that you don't necessarily see when you're younger. But I have chef mentors that are incredibly important that taught me how to cook, that had that. They displayed that comfortability in the kitchen, a mastery of food and flavors, and they also knew what their own boundaries were, right? It wasn't like just the sky's the limit. They had kind of created this style that was really... It to me at the time, it didn't have boundaries, but at the same time, it was so consistent and fluid that it made a lot of sense. And as a young chef, you're kind of all over the place. And I would imagine, you know, just like a young filmmaker, a young artist. I mean, you know, and your style changes as you evolve. And I mean, obviously, our restaurants are all over the place too. So maybe it hasn't changed, or maybe that is our mastery in that regard. But I think that that mentorship aspect is, it becomes a lifetime. I mean, cooking is a lifetime's worth of work. It's not something that you just kind of start and enjoy. I mean, I really do feel like you've got to spend a lot of time, a lot of practice. It's, you know, to really master the anchovy, I probably have butchered 40 or 50,000 anchovies in my career. And I feel like I've got it, and I can teach that. And I've taught many young cooks how to. And in that, you develop a philosophy of, you know, when you want them brought to your kitchen out of the water, right? Today, just as, you know, this morning I was holding anchovies that were in rigor mortis that were 2 hours out of the water. And we have protocols set in our kitchens now for those anchovies. And I guess what that means is that it's just that it's not just working with the freshest. It's that this is our philosophy in the kitchen. It's developing that. And that comes through a lot of mentorship of other philosophies that you adapt and you adhere to. And you are, as a sous chef or a young chef in their kitchen, your job is to adhere to those tastes. It's your job to adhere to the philosophy of the restaurant and the culture and be a part of that culture.
So you learn about yourself by being, it's sort of like the, by being in someone else's mm-hmm. confined idea.
I think so. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. You enter that kitchen and you're going for a reason. You're not going to just because it's a job. You're going because you're seeking out a slew of skills and tastes that are appealing to you, or the direction, they're the things that you want to take on and learn so that you can start building your own foundations and kind of get to that place.
We actually, the last time we won a James Beard, we mentioned all of our mentors on the podium because we feel so strongly about sort of promoting the idea of that, because it's not quite as, it's getting slightly diluted, it seems, sort of as the culture has shifted a little bit in restaurants and kitchens. So we're continually telling all of our young chefs, like, these are the people that we worked for. And, you know, this chef taught me about these things, and this restaurateur taught me these things, and this is how we do it now here. And so they can sort of see how we have filtered it and made it apply to what we do, which is very different from what they were doing.
Yeah, I would say our cooking is much different than it was 15 years ago or, you know, in their kitchens, or even the thought process of the food that we wanted to cook. But their food and their skills and the mentorship that they had received when they were young chefs, has all trickled down to make us, I think, who we are. So, absolutely. It's a big, big part.
I mean, I read an interview with you where you said 90% of what you do is working with your staff. So is that part of, trying to keep that idea of mentorship going is to mentor your staff?
Oh, most definitely. I think, we opened State Bird. There was 16 of us when we opened in 2012, and now 4.5 years later, there's nearly 100 employees in that building. And it's something that we discuss a lot. We talk about, kind of the type of restaurant and business that we want to be that employees are coming to seek out, right? What we want to show is kind of the culture that supports the restaurants. And so we often say, and I'm very forward on this when we hire employees, and I don't feel like that this is necessarily the way that we both learned to be. I mean, restaurants have evolved tremendously, especially in the last 10 to 12 years, the culture of restaurants significantly. But we spend about 90% of our efforts on our staff and 10% on the guests walking in. And the idea of that is that we're trying to give as much as we can to the people that are going to make this place amazing for, the 100% of the guests who are coming through the door. And we find that business acumen really plays out very well, within our restaurants. It's noticed, I think, throughout. So we tend to talk less about the experience of the guest and more about the experience of our staff. They're the ones who are making it every day, and they spend a lot of time doing amazing work.
I forgot that I wanted to ask you earlier also just about seeing as you had such strong sort of family table experiences that must be hard to recreate when you work in a restaurant, right? Because you're probably not at home cooking for your child mm-hmm. every day. So how cooking fits into your family.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. Somebody interviewed us sort of specifically about that recently, and was thinking of how to answer, and I'm home most nights with our 5.5-year-old having dinner. Stuart is at the restaurant cooking for a couple hundred people. and then on weekends, we obviously try and be together as a family, but our son he was 1 year when we opened State Bird, and so he's been coming. Sometimes he'll come 3 times a week, sometimes he won't come for a few weeks, depending on just what's going on, and he now asks me, now, Mom, are they a part of my restaurant family? Are they a part of my other family? Like, he has this sense that the people at the restaurant are his family. And now when he comes, he's just like, hey, what's up? Like, how's it going? Get my lap chong ready? Ready for some peanut milk? Yeah. He's got his thing. And he brings his friends. He's like, we got to go upstairs. And there's this zone that I want to show you. And they go in the kitchen and they get ice cream sandwich. It's like a thing. So we're sort of giving him an experience through food that might not be traditional, but is very personal still.
Yeah, that's great. I like that.
I would say at home his table manners are not quite the same as probably when we grew up. we're disciplined with our restaurants, but not so disciplined at home.
Slightly feral.
Yeah, he's a bit of a feral
food is
child.
Play.
Yeah.
That's like another. that's another theme.
But he can pick things out of the garden, and he knows exactly what they are. I mean, arugula, carrots, and he spends actually a lot of time in gardens and is really good at detecting and will eat things, dirt and all, still at 5.5 years old.
He likes the dirt.
Yeah, he's just really, really, really into
We've
it.
Had to show him, okay, if it's this low to the ground in the city, you don't eat it. It's got to be, above the pea line. Only fennel this tall.
Yeah. Like I said, feral child. Yeah.
You have to be very careful foraging in an urban environment. Yeah.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program is a discussion on the intersections of cinema, culture, and gastronomy, with our guests Stuart Brioza and Nicole Krasinski, renowned chefs and owners of State Bird Provisions and The Progress, and San Francisco Film Society's Rachel Rosen. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So I was watching an interview with Ang Lee and James Shamus at the Museum of the Moving Image in New York. And David Schwartz, who's the curator there, was talking about Ang Lee's films and the way in which people always sort of talked about him as if he was an inconsistent filmmaker, meaning his films just seem to be different kinds of films that some people can't find a through line between Sense and Sensibility and Pushing Hands. Mm-hmm. And he said that David Schwartz found the through line to all the Ang Lee's films to be compromises, meaning an interest in contradictions. So specifically for Ang Lee, the compromise between tradition and modernity, personal desire and social convention, Eastern and Western. Mm-hmm. And in a lot of ways, I thought, you know, that you could say is kind of applicable to State Bird and the progress. Mm. And I'm wondering what you think about that.
Hmm. Yes. State Bird's a great example of that, right, where we take efficiencies from a Chinese style of cuisine, right, where serving things dim sum on carts and trays. And when you really think about, like, the obvious kind of idea of that service style, it's kind of it just makes sense, right? And every chef that I've met who's come in and said, God, that's such a great idea. What didn't I think of that? and really, I think growing up in the Bay Area and being part of a really a large, a community of cultural diversity, it makes sense when you think about it, because it's this idea where, you know, at the time, I mean, you're just eating Chinese food or Japanese food within homes of friends, and then, you know, as time went on, we would start going out to eat at restaurants, and obviously, you know, dim sum is just such a pleasant way to eat and fun when you're young and you're experiencing new styles of restaurants, and I think it was a vortex of, you know, people still wanting to have really bright flavors and small plates, but everybody was burned out on tapas and because it just had been done so wrong for so long in this country. We don't have a culture of small plates. It was kind of a combination of that and a little American ingenuity, and you know, voila, you know, came this idea of Eastern, Western, but thoroughly, what I'd like to think is thoroughly San Francisco and Bay Area, is the style of food. It would be a contradiction, of course, because, you know, dim sum is served as a tea service during the day, and we're only open for dinner, and, you know, we're not Asian, and... we're, you know, American chefs who studied European cooking, but I do think that, you know, much of the melting pot of our society and definitely the Bay Area for certain, it allows for that. And it becomes thought about as a new way of thinking about serving food. However, borrowing from tradition and other areas of the world, right? Things and, you know, obviously where travel comes in and helps to create that.
So there's one scene where Ang Lee, the chef, is called in to help with the governor's son's banquet, and he goes in to help, and Ang Lee chose to shoot it as if he were going into emergency surgery, right? So someone's like helping him into like his whites, and like, I mean, is that like that a scenario like, that like cracks you up, or can you relate to the emergency room in the kitchen?
Totally relatable. Yeah, I mean, I am so looking forward to that day where I can walk into my kitchen and I'm just putting this out and apron is tied around me and, you know, somebody's bringing me tasting spoons and, you know, that is such an epic scene. I mean, just the camera following this chef walking through multiple kitchens with an army of like wok chefs and, you know, garmage chefs and just going through, and it's an enormous, it's like the Palace Hotel
it's
or something.
It's a real
in
wedding, actually. When you see the scene of the crowd, that's like someone's real wedding banquet.
Like being filmed?
Yeah, they let them like
that's
do
a way
a
to
few
cost.
Shots.
It's good for the budget.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
that's how I would think about that. Hey, kill two birds with one stone. But that is such an epic scene, and one that is absolutely like, you know,
We're not saving lives, we're saving fermentations.
That's right.
It's like, chef, it's important. Yeah. There's this really weird orange mold. What do we do?
Or, you're cooking for 50 and you're roasting a meat. And, it's sort of like there is that expertise that comes in because there's an uncertainness, from the younger cooks or, but, yeah, that I just relate to that, because of scenes like that, and I think that there's another one, that's just similar, like kind of takes you through this dramatic scene change of a restaurant, like in the movie The Cook, the Thief, his wife and her lover, they go from the kitchen to the dining room to the kind of hallway outside of the restrooms and to the restrooms, and all through that, changes in color and style, and it's such a dramatic change. And every morning I walk into the restaurant and, it's two, but there's like five kitchens. Many of you probably don't know that, but there's five kitchens in our building now. And so it starts off and I have my path. Right, and I kind of weave through, and go and say hello to the prep guys in the back, and the saucier in the morning of State Bird, and walk into, and generally there's like something on the stove, and the chef tastes this, and it's like I've got my computer bag on my shoulders, and you inspect the quality of an ingredient, and kind of move through and look at the garbage area. It looks a little tattered. Talk to another chef about that. And, and then I walk into Progress and, check out to see what they're doing and, similar aesthetic, and go up the stairs. And, up the stairs is where our butchery is and where all the activity is happening.
And the lights, it's like the lights are really bright.
Yeah, and you go from this kind of warm wood tone up the stairs and natural light into like a bright white kitchen, and there's fish being butchered, and there's large cuts of meat, and there's things being smoked, and lots of vegetable boxes kind of being put away, and talking to all the chefs, and there's usually about, I don't know, maybe 10 to 12 questions that have to be rapid-fired answered, right? So Christina will say, chef, we don't have halibut today, but we've got, here are the options. What do you want to do? Let's do this. Okay, next, can you try this? Because I wasn't totally sure on the salting of this, these duck necks, And then it moves into another. And then I walk up into pastry kitchen and say hello to the pastry. And then I go into the office and just sort of like put my bag, put my apron on, and walk back out and start the day. And there is these scene changes.
It's
very, very cinematic, and it feels that way. And it's one of probably the biggest joys of my day is just walking through the front door of the building and just saying hello to every single person and checking in with them because of that kind of, I don't know, it's this thing. And so when I watch that chef, that scene, him going through, and you can see him kind of pointing as he's going through, and getting the nod from the younger chefs, and it really feels like that. It's not that different, right?
It's very true to reality.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right, I'm gonna let some other people ask some questions.
Oh, wonderful.
I believe you're doing a cookbook for State Bird.
Yes.
And what's the philosophy behind it?
It's really about State Bird and the food there. So it's sort of, it's that, but it's also kind of how we get to those places and a little bit of a key into the creative process as we see it.
Hi.
Sure. Hi. I just wanted to ask, I read an article a long time ago talking about how the restaurant goers in Chicago allowed the chefs to be really creative, and they felt like they had this blank canvas to work on. And I believe that both of you trained in Chicago. Mm-hmm. I was curious, do you think the San Francisco population also allows you to be as creative as you want, or is there a little bit of catering to the audience that you're working with?
Mm. I think yes, now. I think that, and when we worked in Chicago, it was I think, prior to some of the revolution that's happening currently, right? So this was late 90s. And Chicago, and still is to this day, is a big meat and potatoes, but there is a lot of sort of avant-garde cookery happening, and it makes total sense when you think about the architecture and design that happens in Chicago. So I think it's happening now. And I think in San Francisco, a lot has changed over the last 10 years. And we've been cooking in San Francisco here since 2004 as chefs. We were chefs at Rubicon. And I didn't feel that as I do today. I would like to say State Bird probably has a little bit to do with that, because we opened after 3.5 years out of restaurants, and we kind of just didn't really pay attention to what was happening in the outer world. We opened with this idea of, like, we're going to kind of just cook with freedom and flexibility and not be bound to tradition and, you know, wine pairings that start off light and go to heavy, you know, where you're kind of ascending the mountain and then you get to the top and it's your big Napa cab and big steak and, you know, and you're just sort of like, it gets richer and heavier as you get to the top of the mountain, right? Which makes, like, no sense. Cooking... You know, it goes back to that idea of, like, bright flavors. That's what we... I think that there are specifics in San Francisco, as we've got a really a very intelligent dining community here. They know flavors. They know food. They know farms. They are very in tune with the seasons. You know, I think that there are specific rules that we as chefs, like, we all, like, unite and abide by, right? Which is those ideas. But I think that, one of the greatest things about cooking in San Francisco right now is that it's a little bit of wild, wild west, you know, with some really great foundational rules that... only work out for all of us, which is just, like, incredible ingredients, right? So I would say that there's a lot of freedom here. There's also a lot of great pizza and burgers too, in this town, right? Which are pretty much just, like, you know, great to eat. You know?
Okay. Hi. What's your feeling on the new greatest hits restaurant in situ? SF MoMA.
Oh, that's interesting. I think it's a really smart idea, thinking about these plates as collections of work, bodies of work. And I think food, thinking about chefs are known for specific dishes, and... you know, you go to those restaurants, right? We travel to those restaurants because of a dish that's their signature dish. And you want to experience that, even though you've seen it blasted up and down Twitter, Instagram, Bon Appetit, Food & Wine, every food magazine and periodical and internet website relating to that restaurant, you still want to go and experience that, right? I think of Thomas Keller's Oysters and Pearls, and he's still cooking that dish, and it's this thing that, yeah, if you go to the French Laundry and you don't have that Oysters and Pearls, you're going to be really let down. So the idea of Corey Lee, who's a tremendous chef, taking these works of art and centering it in a museum is a pretty fascinating process. I do have one thought on it from one of my sous chefs is a sous chef at the restaurant. And I remember he was, when he left, he really wanted to go and experience and travel and work in kitchens, in France and Italy. And he had some really specific ideas about it. And his wife, who works with us still, said she didn't want to travel. She was really happy right here. And really wanted to continue. And so, you know, when this became an opportunity, he thought, well, if I can't travel the world to go and experience these dishes, this is an interesting place for me to go and at least get the experience of working these dishes. And I thought that was a really smart thing, and for a young cook, with the caveat that part of the dishes that you're learning, if someone else was producing my dish, it's coming with very little substance behind it. It's a recipe, it's photographs, it's a listing of methods and steps to perfect, to create this. But it doesn't come with the philosophy, it doesn't come with the restaurant, the culture of the restaurant. It does, you know, it's missing all of those items, right? And where it made me realize that as much as we think of food as art, food is much deeper than just what you're seeing on a wall as a museum piece. Food, I like to think that food comes with, the food that we create is a product of its environment, right? And a product of all the chefs and all the waiters and the walls and the artwork that's hanging on the walls and the music that's playing and the lighting. All of that really helps to make up food. So I don't know if that answered your question, but it's just a thought and a theory. And I can't wait to eat there, to try these dishes. Mm-hmm. Within this kind of black and white museum focused environment.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Stuart, Nicola, and Rachel. Thank you all for coming. Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs of the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's program was a discussion on the intersections of cinema, culture, and gastronomy with our guests Stuart Brioza and Nicole Krasinski, renowned chefs and owners of State Bird Provisions and The Progress, and San Francisco Film Society's Rachel Rosen. The discussion took place before a film screening of Ang Lee's poignant family drama, Eat, Drink, Man, Woman, at the JCCSF. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Alex Espalet, Dan Folds, Carly Mari, and Aiden Nelson. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Tina Pimentuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.